This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his Old Testament History, Literature, and Theology course, lecture number 24, on David, his compassion, his passion, and his hatred of evil.
Class, couple things. For next week, for next Thursday, you folks are working on the prophets, and so there'll be select readings on the prophets. I've not checked the online thing. So there's selected readings there. And so give me till tomorrow morning to actually get that accurate and things. But you can start working on some of the prophets and things like that. But some of the select readings, I'm not sure whether the syllabus is right. My guess is the syllabus is right, and I want to double check it against the online stuff. So I'll have that perfect by tomorrow morning. So, but basically what we'll be working on is the prophets. And then the week after that, we're what? Next Thursday is our... Next Thursday is our last quiz day. Boy, isn't that going to be a sad day? Anyways, and then after that, we've just got the final left, and the final will go from the last exam up there. I'll probably put out a study guide for the final after our last Thursday class the next morning, Friday morning. I'll have a study guide out for that and stuff. So, okay, well, let's jump in. Today, we're going to focus totally on David's life. Before we had introduced David and Saul and the kind of David when he was younger and David's marriage to Michal, Saul's daughter, and basically fleeing from Saul, was trying to kill him for a number of years. And then basically at the end of the book of Samuel, Saul himself is going to this witch of Endor. And what happens is the witch of Endor brings Samuel up. No, she doesn't bring Samuel up. She's more startled, I think, than anyone when Samuel actually comes up. She freaks out. And then Saul basically talks, interviews with Samuel, and Samuel tells Saul, "You and your boys are going to be with me tomorrow," which means basically Saul is told in chapter 28 that he's going to be dead, that he's going to be with Samuel, who had died in chapter 25. So today, we want to look at some things about David, and the big thing with David that I'm not going to take 2 Samuel chronologically. What I'm going to deal with it is more thematically, and the theme that I want to develop is that David was a man after God's own heart, and my question is, what does it mean to be a person after God's own heart? So I want to look at King David as a model of how one becomes, and what it meant to be a person after God's own heart. So in order to do that, I'm going to take themes in David's life. And the first theme in David's life that I want to examine is David's compassion. David's compassion. And so I'm going to go through various scenarios of David's compassion. And we'll talk about David's passion. And then we'll talk about David's hatred of evil. But for first on his compassion, who killed Saul? Does anybody remember reading the end of 1 Samuel? And it says, like, Saul killed himself. And then when you turn over to the next one, and let me just read 1 Samuel chapter 31, down verse 4 and following. It says, "The fighting grew so fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically." So Saul, a guy shot a bow and arrow, the arrow hits him. He's wounded critically. They couldn't get the medevac helicopter into him. And so Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer was terrified and would not do it. By the way, who also had an armor bearer? Does anybody remember Goliath? Goliath had his armor bearer, and now Saul's got his armor bearer. And the armor bearer probably is really loyal to Saul, had carried his weapons out for him to battle and things. The armor bearer, Saul tells to kill him, and basically the armor bearer won't do it. Does it take quite a bit for a person to kill another human being? It's a big deal. I don't know whether you guys know that in World War II, a lot of the guys that went into battle shot their guns in the air, did not shoot at another person. Because they were basically, there was this, to draw your gun and to shoot another person is a really hard thing to do. And so in a lot of the earlier wars, the people shot their guns in the air. And I forget what it's a huge percentage of guys never really actually put a bead on somebody and took them down and stuff. So it's interesting. Those kind of facts don't usually get out. But what happens is then, but his armor bearer was terrified and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, so Saul, he's shot critically, but he's still alive. He falls on his own sword. The armor bearer won't kill him. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and he died. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together that same day. And so you have this kind of tragic ending for Saul and things. But what's interesting is when you turn the page, so in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel, it's Saul killed himself. He fell on his sword. He killed himself. That's, we call it suicide. He committed suicide and fell on his sword. But when you flip the page and you go over to 2 Samuel chapter 1, it says this down about verse 10. Actually, let me start up a little ways. There's an Amalekite who got away. So there's an Amalekite comes to David. Let me just tell a story. The Amalekite comes to David with the crown of Saul and the band from his arm. Now, by the way, will David immediately recognize that crown as being Saul's? Yes. So the Amalekite comes to David and with the crown and the band and stuff. And then he said, the Amalekite's narrating the story, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, the young man said, and there was Saul leaning on his spear with chariots and riders almost upon him. He turned around and saw me, and he called out to me and said, and I said, what can I do? He asked me, who are you? An Amalekite, I answered. And then he said to me, stand over me and kill me. I am in the throes of death, but I am still alive. So I stood over him and I killed him. Because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm, and I brought them here to my Lord. So the question is, who killed Saul? From what I understand, you can only get killed once, okay? So that's what I understand anyways. And so did Saul kill himself, or did this Amalekite kill him? And so this becomes a question. And there's basically two options. Now, there may be more. You guys are more creative than I am, so there may be more options. But here's two possible options on this. One is Saul was shot. He then fell on his sword, but he was still alive. When you fall on a sword like that, does a person die slowly usually? And does it take a lot and things? And so he falls on his sword. So he's still kind of groveling around. He's still alive. And then he calls out to the Amalekite, come over and finish me off. Okay, and so that's the first scenario, is the Amalekites telling the truth. Saul had fallen on his sword, had given himself a mortal wound, He was going to die from the wound, but he calls the Amalekite to say, finish me off more quickly so the Philistines don't catch me and do some sort of torture on me and it gets really ugly. So in that case, the Amalekite would be telling the truth. That's possible. I think what's probably more likely is it likely that the Amalekite's lying? And then what happened is Saul fell on his sword, and Saul died then, and the Amalekite is lying to David, grabbed the crown off Saul's head and the band off his arm, and brought them to David, because what is the Amalekite wanting? It's like, hey, he's wanting a reward from the new king. He's bringing the crown to the new king. And so he basically makes up this story and tells it to David, hoping for a reward. Now, what's the problem? When the Amalekite tells David, question, do you touch your David? Do you touch the Lord's anointed?
No.
Okay. And so this Amalekite has now claimed that he's slain the Lord's anointed. So this guy is his own death sentence. And by the way, there's some irony here too. The guy claims he's an Amalekite. Do you remember Saul in 1 Samuel 13? Who was Saul supposed to wipe out? What tribal group was he supposed to wipe out? The Amalekites, and he refused to do it. And now you've got an Amalekite standing over Saul in his death. And so anyways, but my guess is that the guy is lying, wanting a reward from David. He goes to David. David says, man, you messed with the Lord's anointed. You're a dead man. And so David puts the Amalekite to death. Now, you say, well, this isn't real compassionate, okay? But there's some things here I think we need to talk about. If a person commits suicide, do they go to hell because of unconfessed sin? Now, I realize this isn't really much of a question in Massachusetts, because in Massachusetts, everybody goes to heaven. But in other parts of the world, they, you know, think that there's a place called hell. And so a person commits unconfessed sin. Their last act is a murder of themselves. Their last act is a murder of themselves, and therefore there's unconfessed, you know, there's no sin, there's sin in that, and basically the person is rebelling. And so some people think that if a person commits suicide, that they basically go to hell and things. I think that's wrong. Let me tell you one story and then let me illustrate out of the text. By the way, when I look around a class this size, are there some of you that know what it's like to have friends and family that have committed suicide? Okay. Is that a real serious issue? My son got back from Afghanistan. When he got back from Iraq, on the first thing, he got back from Iraq, one of his friends, I better be careful about how many is it. But a lot of his friends just get drunk all the time, okay? You know what I'm saying? They're Marines, they get drunk all the time, just trying to forget what they saw. Another guy of his friends, he said this guy was totally well-adjusted. He was a quiet guy, totally well-adjusted, everything. Somebody went in his room and got him just before he had an M16 up his mouth and was going to pull the trigger. And somebody broke into his room and knocked the gun away and stuff like that. And went, but unfortunately, there were some other people who they didn't get to in time, and there were people that he came back with that committed suicide. The one for me that's most outstanding, let me tell you a story about I'll call him Mr. Mill. Mr. Mill was a multimillionaire. He was from Columbus, Ohio. He was in a very big business. He was so well known in that town that when he would go into a restaurant, his favorite restaurant, that they didn't even ask Mr. Mill what he wanted to order. They knew what he wanted, and so they ordered for him. And this guy was like, you know, the limo, the big, you know, multimillionaire kind of guy. His sons, I was teaching with his two sons, PhDs, wonderful young men at the time. We were in our early 30s, and wonderful people, wonderful family, wonderful wife and stuff, big business. He retired from the business. He didn't have anything to worry about the rest of his life. He was well set. When he left the business, he kind of lost his reason for living because the business was so much a part of his life. And now all of a sudden, he's sitting around and he doesn't know what to do with himself. And he's getting more and more and more depressed, more and more and more depressed. And then one day, his wife went out to the garage, and he had strung himself up and hung himself in their garage. They can say, how did you get in on this? Because, well, they called me because I was basically the same size as he was. And so basically, I got all these really expensive clothes that he had bought. And I wore Mr. Mill's clothes for probably 10 years at least. And actually, I still have. What was amazing to me was his shoes. I have a very wide feet. I take a 10.5 triple E. In other words, I always have to get 12s or something because my feet are so stinking wide, I can never find shoes that fit, so I always get them really long. That way the width doesn't. Mr. Mill broke his toe when he was younger, and guess what size shoes he wore? 10.5 triple E. I can't even go to a shoe store and find them. And he bought, whenever he bought shoes, he bought two pairs of them. And so till this day, actually, when I was at my daughter's wedding, I was wearing Mr. Mill's shoes. They're very nice, you know, beautiful. They're $100 shoes. They're actually, $100 for you guys isn't much today for shoes and stuff. But back then, those were beautiful leather shoes. Mr. Mill was a Christian all his life, involved in the church in his life. His two sons, as I said, teaching with me in a very Christian school. His wife, a wonderful Christian. Question, did he go to hell because he hung himself like that? And I want to say, to say that, would that be really wicked, cruel to his wife? You'd never, you know, think to say, hopefully you're smarter than that. But what does the Bible say? Okay, this is a real issue. Have you ever been around somebody? Yeah.
Someone who has depression, you have to look at mental illnesses, as you right. said, with a physical illness, so he wasn't really responsible yeah. for his acts.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a problem with some of this. I have a mental illness. I'm not responsible for my acts. No, I know. You probably aren't going overboard, but I'm just thinking about that Norwegian guy. Do you realize that Norwegian guy that blew, 77 people away? Oh. They basically said he's crazy, and so the guy's not going to jail. Okay, now they'll put him away for some psychiatric thing, but it's just, I was floored. But so there's balance with that, but yeah, so he's not, but depression, yeah, depression, so...
Bad.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I don't know where the line is for responsibility and irresponsibility. I also know, and I've had personal experience this with my dad when my dad was dying of cancer. My dad was a Christian, how should I say? My dad, I look up to my dad. I think he was a better Christian man than I'll ever be. And I really, really respected my dad. But when he was going down, he had cancer all through him. And I don't want to tell you how much pain that was, pancreatic cancer. I was pumping. He would not let anybody else give him morphine. I was the only one he would let give him morphine. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not a doctor, but I'm not that kind of doctor. But he wouldn't trust anybody that I was giving him morphine and stuff. And toward the end, he pleaded for death. In other words, he pleaded for death. What do you do when actually he's pleading, saying he wants to die? He wants to go to be with the Lord and stuff, and this pain is just was just horrendous and stuff. What do you do? I mean, you see what I'm saying? There's conflicts and stuff over this kind of stuff. And anyways, look, praise God for me. I didn't have to make that decision. It was about 3 days later he died of his own accord and stuff, but it was horrendous in the meantime. So all I'm saying is, and some of you know what I'm talking about because you've had friends that have committed suicide, you've had family members, it just rips your guts out. And let me just go to a passage. What does the Bible say about this, okay? Do you remember back, now, by the way, do you remember back in 1 Samuel 28? Samuel comes up, and what does Samuel say to Saul? Tomorrow, you and your sons will be where? With me. Now, you could say, well, Hildebrand, that means they'll be dead, okay? But notice he says, tomorrow you and your sons will be... Now, we don't know about all the rest of the sons, but one of the sons that dies here that we do know is Jonathan. Question, is Jonathan like one of the best in all of the Bible? So I want to say, if he and his sons, what I'm saying is then that Saul and his sons go to be where Samuel is, and that Samuel is one of the great prophets, is a good place. Yeah, so I want to say it's in heaven probably. And so I would use that 1 Samuel 28. It isn't a conclusive, you know what I'm saying? I can't, you know, do a philosophical analysis or exegetical analysis to prove it and stuff. But I'm saying there seems to me that the evidence leans that direction then.
Yeah,
that
Saul, what I was trying to get at is, you know, how mental illnesses take physical manifestations. So couldn't you say, I guess you couldn't go that severe. Like, say someone dies of diabetes.
Yeah.
Him killing himself would really, the depression.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not...
Yeah, it depends. And what I'm saying is I don't know where the line is from somebody that's just down and that... And so I got to leave that off. But it does seem like the text indicates that Saul and his sons went to be with Samuel, which is a good place. So I want to say that we've got some biblical data for that. Now, David, here's where David gets back on. David does a eulogy for Saul. Now, do you know what the word eulogy is? Eulogy is what? Usually when somebody dies, you do a eulogy. The word you on the front of stuff, you, it means what in Greek and actually in English? You means good. Like if somebody does a eulogy or what's a... Does anybody know what a euphemism is? A euphemism is when you speak well. This is a eulogy. Logy is from logos. Logos, like logos means in the beginning was the logos, in the beginning was the word. The word was with God. The good word. So what happens is he's going to do a eulogy, a good word for Saul. But was Saul the very person that had been trying to kill him for years? And here's what David says about Saul. He's gone. Praise God. The guy is dead. He's been trying to kill me for years. He finally got what was coming to him. Is that what David said? Here's what David says in his eulogy. David is a poet, as you know from the book of Psalms. David writes half the book of Psalms about. David says this, Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious. They were loved and gracious in life. Do you remember all that stuff? Saul was trying to kill him? And so he says in the eulogy, he was loved and gracious. And in death, they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How have the mighty fallen in battle? Is he praising Saul here? The guy that had been trying to kill him for years. The guy who the king, the spirit had been off him, and the spirit come on David, and he'd been trying to kill him. This is amazing. So this shows me David's compassion. That here, David's not vindictive, he's not vengeful. Saul tried to do all sorts of nasty stuff to him. When he dies, David laments for Saul. Now, this part is kind of really weird. I hate bringing it to text, but this is the way, from the 21st century, this is how these texts are looked at. He says, I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. Was Jonathan David's best friend? Jonathan was David's best friend. His best friend has just died. Is that a big deal? When one of your best friends dies, does that do something to you? Okay? My son can tell you about that. Okay? When somebody you care about, you spent, and you're like your best friend, and they die and stuff, that affects you big time. So I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You are very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. Question, how do people in the 21st century understand that? Yeah, they take it as that David and Jonathan had a gay relationship. His question, does that have anything to do with anything here? Is it? No, it doesn't. And so to read that in, Now, you can say, well, we do reader response and stuff. Yeah, you can do all you want, okay? But what I'm talking about is the fact that David and Jonathan, they were friends. Is it possible for males to have friendships without being gay? Okay? And so what I'm saying is, here you've got two guys that are just like blood brothers and just close in battle, close in life, and here he dies, and David says, you know, I had a special relationship with this guy, Jonathan, and stuff. He's basically his best friend. So be careful about how the scriptures get twisted in the 21st century. I think it's really wrong. Now, yes, sir.
Didn't he also have a bad run with some of his wives?
David had plenty of wives. Okay, and we're going to get to that. Okay, give me about 10 minutes. We'll get to David's wives and stuff. Yeah, I mean, some of them were good.
He might kind of say that as like.
Does everybody hear that? Even to a philosopher to come up there. The reason he loved her is more love than women because he had such a bad experience with women. No, I don't do that. No. I mean, there may be an ounce of truth to that, but I want to, let's do something different here. Okay. Interesting suggestion. I've never heard that before. Interesting suggestion. Okay. Now, Abner and Ishbosheth, who are these guys? First of all, David now, Saul is dead. Saul is dead. You guys are Israel. Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. You guys are Jordan, you're Israel, the Mediterranean Sea. David takes over Israel. So David gets this territory. Saul's son is named Ishbosheth, and Ishbosheth takes over this area in Jordan. So Ishbosheth has this, David has this. Now, was Ishbosheth really the guy's name? The guy's name is Ishbosheth, but actually, when you look over in Chronicles, you say, Hildebrand, why don't you like the name Ishbosheth? Would you name your son this? Ishbosheth means man of shame. Would you name your kid man of shame? You say, that's a really odd name for a kid. Nobody would ever really do that to their kid, I don't think. But what happens is, if you go over into Chronicles, you see that his real name was Ishbaal. Ishbaal means man of what? Man of Baal means man of Baal. And by the way, the Hebrew there, Baal, when I say Baal, what comes to your head? Baal worship and things like that. Baal and Asherah worship from the Canaanites and stuff. That probably wasn't how the kid was named. Baal can also mean like owner or master. Man of the master, which would be, Saul would say man of the master, and that he was the big Baal guy, okay? In other words, that he was the owner of the master. So I think what you have here is, I think Ishbosheth is his nickname, that later scribes and stuff didn't like writing that name to Ishbaal, and they didn't, you know, because of man of Baal. And so what basically the guy, even probably in his own lifetime, was called Ishbosheth, man of shame. So I think that the Ishbosheth is like a nickname. Do you nickname people? Do you nickname people with various names? Somebody's got an offensive name or something. Yes, Hannah.
What do you think Nabal's name?
Pardon?
What do you think Nabal's name was really then?
No, I think Nabal's name may have been Fool, but he may have been named for, well, may have been his nickname too. I mean, it's hard to say. With Nabal, all we've got is Nabal's name. With this, we've got his other name. So this one, we know there's actual text things, but you're in 1 Samuel 25 there with Nabal. So, okay, now, so Ishbosheth is Saul's son, but what we need to know is, Ishbosheth, who is Saul's general? Saul, King Saul, had a general. His name was Abner. David had a general, and his general's name was Joab. Okay, so those are the two guys. Saul had his main general was Abner. David's main general was Joab. Now, when Joab appears in the narrative, what's Joab going to do? Almost every time he does exactly the same thing. Joab does what to people? Yeah, Joab kills them, okay? Joab is a killer, okay? Joab is David's general, and almost every time he appears in the narrative, he's killing somebody, okay? Abner is Saul's general, and he's going to do some things there too. Joab, then, is going to kill Abner. And let me just tell you the story of how this happens, and then I want to look at David's compassion in the story. Joab and Abner were the two generals of Saul and David, respectively. They got together at a pool called the Pool of Gibeon. Do you remember the Gibeonites, okay, the ones that made an alliance with Israel? There's a pool in Gibeon about from that pillar to this pillar to around where I am. It's a huge pool. There's a pool. And Joab's men and Abner's men sat around the pool, and Joab and Abner, the two generals, say, hey, why don't you let these young guys get up and grapple and fight each other? see whose guys are tougher, you know, that kind of thing. So the guys get up and they start getting into, you know, battle and stuff, and then it gets thicker and thicker, and all of a sudden people start killing each other. So Abner says, I'm getting out of here. This is getting dangerous. You know, these guys are killing stuff. So Abner takes off running. Now, Abner's the big, strong general. Joab's younger brother is a guy named Asahel, and it says he was fleet of foot, which meant he was quick. And so Asahel chases after Abner, and Abner turns around to Asahel and he says, Asahel, get off my tail, man. I don't want to hurt you, because if I hurt you, I got to answer to whom? Your older brother. Do older brothers take care of younger brothers? And so what happens is, actually, I got a great story of that when I was young. When I was young, this happened 40 years later. My brother remembered this. When I was young, my brother came home from school one day and some kids had jumped up and beat him up, okay? He got home. I'm the older brother. What did I do? I whip off my belt, put it around my fist, and I went out and took care of business, okay? And so when I got home, it was just over, you know what I'm saying? It's over. It's cool. We're done. They won't be bothering you again. It's okay and stuff. I get home. Did you know, 40 years later, when one of my kids was getting married, my brother was telling nasty stories about me. And what he says is, one of the things I remember about my brother was that whenever I got in trouble like that, he'd go out and took my side. He protected me, and he took care of business and stuff. And he remembered that 40 years later. I had forgotten totally about it. But anyways, what I'm saying is, the older brother. So what happens? Abner says to Asahel, get off my tail. I don't want to fight Joab, so just back off. He takes the butt end of his spear, and he pushes the kid back with the butt end of his spear. But what's the problem? The butt end of the spear goes through the kid, and he ends up killing the kid by accident. And then it's like, oh, no, Joab's going to be on his case. So now what happens? Abner's over here with Ishbosheth, and Ishbosheth has got Saul's concubine, who's named Ritzba. I never could understand that. It's like the floor lady. Ritzba means floor. But anyways, so Abner says, can I have Ritzba, the concubine of Saul? And Ishbosheth freaks out. And Abner says, hey, man, I fought for Saul like for 20 years and stuff, and now you won't. Nothing. She says, I'm going over to David. So basically, Abner takes himself and his troops. He goes over to David. And he says to David, I want to make an alliance with you. I'll bring the kingdom over to you, David. You'll have territories on both sides of the Jordan River now. And basically, Abner and David make an alliance. Joab's not there. Joab shows up and he says, hey, David, you should never have made an alliance with Abner. Abner tried to kill you, man. What'd you do that for? So Joab sends and says, Abner, come back here. Abner comes back thinking he's going to talk with Joab. Joab takes out his knife, sticks him in the fifth rib, kills Abner in cold blood. So now Abner is dead and he's been killed in cold blood. And what's David's response to this? Joab stabbed him. And it says down in verse 32, this is chapter 3, verse 32, it says, they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king wept aloud at Abner's tomb. And all the people wept also. Abner was killed in cold blood by Joab. That was murder. Joab killed him. The king sang a lament for Abner. And then the people came and urged David to eat something. Why did the men come and... David was what? He wasn't eating. Okay, when something's really tragic, you don't eat, right? So David's fasting and just not eating because he's so upset with this while it was still day. But David took an oath saying, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I taste bread or anything else before the sun sets. All the people took note and were pleased. Indeed, everything the king did pleased them. So on that day, all the people and all Israel knew that the king had no part in it. Okay, so David wept for Abner, and he said basically wouldn't eat until, you know, the sun was down and stuff. And David and all the people knew that David had nothing to do with the murder of Abner, and that it was Joab's fault. Okay, so David's compassionate, and even with his enemy here, he shows respect to Abner, even though Abner had tried to kill him. So David's response and the people's response is the people know David had compassion on Abner, his enemy, and weeps for them. And this is kind of how the story goes down. That's a second situation where David shows compassion. Here's another one. This is over in chapter 9, 2 Samuel chapter 9. This is a beautiful story. Not totally beautiful, but it's Mephibosheth. Say that fast three times. Mephibosheth, okay? Mephibosheth. David now is king over everything. He's got Israel, he's got Jordan, the area. David's the king over everything. Okay, David says, are there any of Saul's descendants that I can help? David's in position of power. Now he says, are there any left over of Saul's descendants that I can help? And they say, yeah, there's one guy named Mephibosheth. But he's what's Mephibosheth's problem? He's lame in both legs. Apparently when the nurse was carrying him, either she had dropped him or fell on him or something. And the guy's crippled in both legs. Now, by the way, in our culture, if you're crippled in both legs, is it really a big problem? You can get prosthetics, you can get, you know, elevators taking you up, you get a wheelchair, you can even race in the wheelchair and things. Anyways, in our culture, it's a problem, but not a real. In that problem, when you don't have a question, did they have wheelchairs? Did they have, you know, escalators? Did they have elevators and things like that? No. And so this guy, David, looks at this guy and says, oh, Mephibosheth is whose son, by the way? Jonathan's son. And remember, David made a vow with Jonathan that he would take care of his descendants forever? So David basically takes care of Mephibosheth, and this is just a beautiful situation. He says, Mephibosheth, you can eat at my table from now and forever. You are considered like one of the king's sons. I will feed you forever. And that was the first welfare program that was ever in existence. David taking care of Mephibosheth. Okay? That's kind of the storyline behind it. And this is the point that I want to draw from it. Okay, the goodness of a person can be seen, can be measured on how they treat people who cannot pay them back anything. Okay, you want to get a promotion and you're working down at a corporation down in Boston like my son was. A guy comes in, he works 4 hours a day. You come in and you work 8-9 hours a day. The guy works 4 hours a day. Even in those 4 hours, he barely does any work. But question, what does the four-hour-a-day guy do? He goes out golfing with the boss every day. Or every, you know, whenever the boss goes out on weekends and stuff. He goes what with the boss? He goes golfing all the time with the boss. Kind comes for raises. Who's going to get the raise? The one that goes out golfing with the boss or the one that does the work? The one that does the work should get the raise. No. The one who is working 4 hours a day, coming in at 10 and going home at 2, going out golfing with the boss, he gets the raise, okay? Is that how it works? You do favors, you become friendly with somebody, and then all of a sudden you get the promotions up and things like that. Now, is that fair? Is that right? No, it's not, but that's how it works oftentimes. Do people work people that are over them? Do people work people that are over them to try to garner favors from them? Okay? That's how it normally works. So you want to go against that. You say, what did Mephibosheth have that David needed? Nothing. And so this, in other words, David is not getting anything out of this. David is just, this is grace. This is grace. This is compassion. David has compassion and grace on Mephibosheth and provides for him. And it's wonderful what David did. He's not wanting anything from Mephibosheth. So how do you treat people that are outcasts? How do you treat people that don't fit in? How do you treat people that don't fit in? That's a mark of your character. And everybody always wants, you know, the people that are on the top, but how do they treat the people on the bottom? David, compassionate guy, he goes after Mephibosheth, invites him into his home, and takes care of him for the rest of his life. Mephibosheth had his problems. Some of the other later things we're going to skip. But now, what about Absalom? This is a one that I want to camp on for a while. Absalom was David's son. And Absalom is going to get in some trouble here, big time. So I want to work through the Absalom story. This shows David's compassion very, very well. First of all, here's how the story goes down. You may remember it. There was a guy named Amnon, and it came to pass, okay, or let me start with chapter 13, verse 1, 2 Samuel 13, 1. In the course of time, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. So Amnon, the son of David, falls in love with Tamar, the daughter of David. Is that a problem? Yeah. Now, by the way, is Amnon half-brother to Tamar? By a different wife, David had Amnon. So they're what, half-brother, half-sister? Okay. And so Amnon falls in love with his half-sister. Okay, remember how I said geography plus hormones equals love. Okay, so there's geography, they're close together in family and stuff, and pretty soon, okay. So Amnon is sick with love. Now question, is it really love or is it lust? What's the difference? Lust is a very consumptive, now kind of thing, whereas love, I'm sorry, I'm going to be really corny, but love waits, okay? Love can wait, lust can't. And so what I'm saying is, so that, okay, Amnon. Now, Amnon can't have her because he's a sister and stuff. So Amnon has a nasty friend named Jonadab. And Jonadab says, I'll take care of the problem, Amnon. Here's what you do. You pretend like you're sick. And you tell the king, I want Tamar, my sister, to bring me in some nice, what is it you eat when you're sick? Chicken soup. Chicken soup. Okay, so bring in some nice chicken soup so it'll make me feel better. I'm sick. So she brings in the chicken soup. She prepares it or whatever it was. He prepares it for him. Amnon sends everybody else out. And then what does he do? He's stronger than she is, and he rapes her. And by the way, if you ever want a passage, just 2 Samuel 13, do you actually have the dialogue between the brother who is going to rape his sister and the sister trying to defend herself? It's actually verbally described here. It says, but he grabbed her and he said to her, come to bed with me, my sister. Don't, my brother, she said. Don't force me. Do such a thing. Does it record the narrative between these two? Okay, it's narrated here. It's incredible. The Bible records something like that. Amnon rapes her because he's stronger than she is. And then what? Then he throws her out. And then this passage just makes you so angry. And then Amnon hated her with an intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he loved her. Can lust turn to hate? And this is what happens. He throws her out. Then he throws her out. And she says, throwing me out's worse than what you already did to me. And so she's really, is bad, okay, really bad. Now, what happens here? Okay, David's family is having problems. Why is David's family having problems? Because David and Bathsheba, that stuff is all, David and Bathsheba lies behind this in chapter 11. Now, how do you tell? Basically, love can wait, else can't. What is the role of the father? Is the role of the father in the family to administer justice to his kids? The role of the father is to administer justice. Does David do anything to Amnon? David doesn't do anything. And so what happens is when the father doesn't administer justice, do the kids take care of it among themselves? When the father doesn't administer justice, the kids take care of it themselves. So what's going to happen is Absalom, who's her sister, or her brother, okay, Tamar has a brother named Absalom. Absalom, now by the way, what do we know about Absalom? Does anybody know, there used to be a guy named Keith Green that I love his music and stuff like that. He's got a big old head of hair and stuff. This guy, Absalom, is known for the hair on his head, big head of hair and stuff, handsome guy, one of the most handsome in all of Israel and stuff. So Absalom is his her older brother. And he says, sister, you go, I'll take care of it. I'll take care of it. So what he does is basically throws a big party and he invites Amnon. And he says, get Amnon drunk. And then when Amnon is drunk, kill him. And so Absalom has his brother, his half-brother Amnon killed for raping his sister Tamar. Absalom kills his brother. Okay? Does it kind of echo back Cain and Abel? You hear any of this stuff? Anyways, a little bit. So Absalom kills Amnon. Now what happens? After Absalom kills Amnon, he flees from the city, goes up toward Damascus, up, you know, out of reach of David. And basically Absalom hides out for a while. He flees. Now, Joab, is Joab a really smart guy? Joab's not maybe too bright himself, but when you want wisdom, what kind of a person do you go to? When you go to somebody, you want somebody shrewd, that's wise, who do you go to? You go to a woman. When you want to bring compassion out of a man, who do you go to? Another big strong man, or do you go to a woman? So he goes to a woman, and the woman comes in. She's from Tekoa. Tekoa is just south of Bethlehem, maybe about 10 miles south of Bethlehem. So David, you know, they're like sister cities. David would have known Tekoa well. So Joab gets this wise woman out of Tekoa. By the way, I should mention, Joab is from what town also? Joab is from Bethlehem. Joab is from the same town as David is. Is it very likely that David and Joab grew up together? And Joab, all their life, they were together kind of thing. So Joab knows David from back when they were in, you know, grade school. Or they didn't have grade school, but anyway, back, you know, when they were kids and grew up with him. And then Joab becomes a great fighter. David, by the way, respects his abilities because he is very gifted at doing what he does. Okay, but now what happens here? Joab goes to the wise woman of Tekoa and says, hey, go tell David this story. So the wise woman of Tekoa goes to David and says, David, I'm a widow. I'm a widow. I don't have a husband, David, and things like that. I've only got two boys. And my two boys got into a fight with one another, and one killed the other one. And now the townspeople are wanting to kill my last son. But if they kill my last son, I'll have what? I'll have nothing. I'll have nothing. David, would you pardon, you know, spare my son? And David says, I'll spare your son. And then what's the wise woman at Tekoa say? Just kidding. You thought it was my son. Why would you spare my son, David? Would you spare your own son? Spare your son Absalom. Forgive him. Let him come back. You spared my son. Why don't you spare your own son? Did you see the argument there? So David says, okay, Absalom can come back. But when he comes back, and this is part of the problem, David says, I don't want to see his face. He can come back to Jerusalem. He can be with his buds and stuff when he comes back. I don't want to see his face. And I want to call that partial forgiveness. Is partial forgiveness dangerous and bad? Yeah. Because partial forgiveness is going to grieve the heart of Absalom, and Absalom is going to get more and more angry at his father. And he's going to get more and more angry at his father. Now, when I say Oedipus complex, what are we talking about there? As soon as I say Oedipus, what comes to your head? Yeah, good old Sigmund Freud, okay? And you guys think, as soon as you hear Sigmund Freud, you think, oh, man, some, you know. No, no. Did Sigmund Freud have it right on some of this stuff? Yeah, he actually, to be honest with you, he had his problems. I'll give you his problems. But Sigmund Freud, Absalom is going to go to kill his father. Absalom is going to go after, he's going to be so hatredful to his father, he's going to go after him to kill him. So this is breeding in Absalom's heart now. Now, let me just set this up. Where does Absalom go to breed the revolt that he needs to revolt against his father? I've skipped this. When David first became king, where did David first administer his kingship from? He administered it from a town called Hebron. Is Hebron the hometown where Abraham and his wives were buried? Hebron. Hebron is a very noble city. The people, even till this day, are noble. I took a picture of a guy in Hebron, and the last thing I remember of that guy was being chased down the road. He chased me with a butcher knife. That's the honest truth. I outran him, obviously, but he was running after me, and I ran for my life. I mean, the butcher knife was about that long. But I took a picture that was wrong, that violated him, and he then proceeded to chase me. I got the picture, though. Anyway, sorry. But anyway. No, I don't want to get into this. It's a long story, but I was wrong. I was wrong. I should have been more sensitive to his culture. And I was a young kid, and I was too stupid at the time. But I didn't deserve getting knifed, but I deserved being chased. Okay, so anyways, Hebron is a noble city. Here's how it worked. David was king in Hebron for 7 years, and then the last 33 years of his reign, he went up to Jerusalem. So the people in Hebron are noble and dignified, even till this day. And they said, David, when you were nobody, we were good enough for you. But as soon as you got to be the big king, David, you moved everybody up to Jerusalem. So now Jerusalem is your big capital, but we were good enough when you were nobody. So question, are the people in Hebron going to feel snubbed by David? Yes. And so Absalom goes to Hebron because he knows that's a weak point, and he also knows the character of these people. And he basically says to them, hey, I want to be president of the United States, so I tell you, all college students, there will be no tuition. You don't have to take out loans. The government will cover all your loans, and I will take care of it, and the prices on your schooling will be slashed in a tenth, and there won't be any tuition and stuff. Free education for all. I'm running for president of the United States. Please vote for Ted Hildebrand. Okay. He approves this message. Okay. Question. When you promise people stuff, will people vote for you? And so Absalom goes down there. It's exactly what it is. He says, if I were king, I would do this. And he tells the people exactly what they want to hear. So pretty soon the people say, oh, Absalom should be king. And so he rallies the people up at Hebron, and they march up to Jerusalem after David. Now, what's the problem? When you go after David and you're Absalom, question, is Absalom a pretty boy? I don't know how else to say it. Absalom's a big, handsome guy with all his hair and stuff like that and stuff. Question, is David a warrior? Tell me about Goliath. Tell me about the battles David is. Is David a warrior? David's a warrior. Could David have stood up to his son and taken him on and probably taken him down? Yeah, David's a warrior. Did David choose to do that? No. David, when he heard that his son was coming up with troops, David fled the city, and he flees out of Jerusalem down into the Rift Valley here and up over into Jordan, and David flees from his son. Okay? David's not wanting to hurt his son and stuff, so David flees, and now what happens? Okay? And the story gets things, okay? Chapter 18, Absalom's catching up with David. So David can't get away now. And Absalom's catching up with him. And so basically David realizes that the two troops are going to go to war with one another and stuff. And so David basically says this. The king commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai. And this is what the king says. David says, be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake. Be gentle with the young man Absalom. In other words, don't kill him. Be gentle with him for my sake. And all the troops heard the king giving the order. David just didn't tell Joab on the side. David announced it in front of all the troops. Be gentle. Don't hurt Absalom, basically. Now, what happens? The story goes, what's Absalom most famous for? His hair. He's riding on a donkey. He goes under a low oak tree, and they have these low-hanging branches in these oak tree. And what happens? His hair gets tangled up in this thing, and all of a sudden the donkey runs off, and Absalom is swinging in the air with no donkey under him, caught in this tree by his hair. Who would be the one person in Israel you would not want to meet at that point? You're totally helpless, and guess who shows up? Joab shows up, sees him dangling in the breeze, and Joab says, I know what to do here. And Joab takes three darts, or the javelins there, but they're darts and stuff, and basically jams them into the guy's heart, kills him. He falls down, 10 men surround him, and they take him out more than that, and they kill him and stuff. So David's son Absalom is killed by Joab and his boys, okay, after David said that. Now, watch David's reaction, and then I want to watch Joab's reaction after this. David gets news that his boy has been killed. Now, by the way, had his boy tried to kill him? Had his boy violated his concubines in the front of everybody, in the sight of everybody, to totally violate David? Yes. Absalom dies. Here's what the king says. The king was shaken, verse 33, chapter 18, verse 33. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Have you ever heard a person grieve where they say the same thing over and over and over again and they're grieving? David is grieving. This is deep grief. Joab was told, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom, and the whole army, the victory that day was turned into mourning because that day the troops heard saying, the king is grieving for his son. The king covered his face and cried aloud, oh, my son Absalom, oh, my son Absalom, my son, my son. Okay, David is really shaken up. His son, whom he loved, is dead now. And so this is David's weeping, his compassion for his son that tried to kill him. This is David weeping for his son that tried to kill him. I think what's more interesting to me than this is Joab's reaction. Joab is the one who killed him. David's weeping. And check out what Joab says here. This is really interesting. Does Joab know David really, really, really well? Joab has grown up with David. Joab has been in war with David. They've been on the chase, being chased by Saul together. Joab knew David like the back of a book. Joab is going to give an indictment against David, and he's going to nail David. And listen to what Joab says. He's going to make an accusation against David. Joab is really ticked. He killed Absalom. Yes, he did, but Absalom should have died, according to Joab. When Joab went into the house of the king and said, today, David, you have humiliated all your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubine. And then he says, David, you know what your problem is? I'll tell you right now, David, this is your major problem, David. You love those that hate you. You love those that hate you. And all of a sudden, you're sitting here thinking, question, can you hear the echo? You love those that hate you. Echo, echo, echo. Sound like somebody else, you know? You love those that hate you. Sound like Jesus? I mean, it doesn't get much closer than that, right? So you get this echo with Jesus. You love those that hate you. That's what Joab, who knows David's heart, says, that's your problem, David. But question, is that the very thing that makes him a man after God's own heart? That he loves those that hates him and stuff. And so it's just a beautiful statement, chapter 19, verse 5, following there. And Joab's got it exactly right. David is a man after God's own heart. He loves his enemies. Now, that's David's compassion. He has compassion on his son Absalom. He has compassion on Saul. He has compassion on Mephibosheth. But what about David's passion? And now for this, we'll jump back to chapter 6 in 2 Samuel about the ark. And I want to bring up this map here and just kind of put a map on it and then just describe what's happening. First of all, the Philistines, remember the Philistines back in 1 Samuel? The Philistines captured the ark, and so they're down here, Gath and Ekron, the Philistines taking it here. The ark then is sent back up to Beit Shemesh, so the cattle basically haul the ark back up to Beit Shemesh, and the ark is down here. Now David, where is David at this time? David's at Jerusalem. David is an administrative genius. This guy is really sharp, okay? David captures Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is what? David captures Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is known as the city of David. It's his city. He captured it, so it is his city. It is the city of David. Jerusalem is the city of David. It's the political capital. Now, what does David say? He said, I know Jerusalem is the political capital, but he says, the ark is down here in a tent. He says, I want to bring the ark to Jerusalem. By bringing the ark to Jerusalem, what does David do? He consolidates the power, so now that Jerusalem will not only be the political capital, but now it will be the religious capital. It'll be like Rome being with Washington, D.C. or something like that, okay? And okay, you know what I'm saying? The political and the religious kind of coming in one. So David is going to haul the ark up. So he's going to haul it from Beit Shemesh up here to Kiriat Yearim. As he goes up to Kiriat Yearim, up into the hills, this is where Uzzah, there's going to be a guy, the ark is going to, the cart's going to hit a rock, Uzzah's going to put Uzzah, and it's going to die here, they take it to Kiriat Yearim, and then a later time, David's going to bring the ark from Kiriat Yearim up to Jerusalem, and David's going to house the ark then in a tent in Jerusalem. So that like a tabernacle structure in Jerusalem, David's going to bring the ark to Jerusalem. But before we get there, let's just kind of walk through what happens as the ark goes up to Jerusalem, because there's some really cool things here. This ark coming up to Jerusalem shows David's passion, shows his passion. But before we get to the passion of his of the joy of David in 2 Samuel 6, let me first hit Uzzah. As the ark is going up to Jerusalem, they put the ark on a cart. Now, first of all, is the ark supposed to travel on a cart? When they went in the wilderness, when they went around Jericho, how was the ark to be transported? With poles on the priests, the priests were to hand carry the ark on poles. They put it on a cart. The cart goes up into the mountains, it hits a rock, and the ark is going to fall off the rock. What does Uzzah do? Uzzah reaches out his hand. By the way, how big is the ark? The ark is about this big by this big. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Is the ark big enough that you could handle it? One person probably. Maybe not pick it up because it's overlaid with gold, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's only about this big, okay? So it's like a small cedar chest. So what happens is it's going down because it hit a rock. Uzzah sticks out his hands to try to keep it on the cart, and God slays Uzzah on the spot. When you violate that which is holy, is there usually a big and, you know, a reaction from God on the spot? Does anybody remember Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus 11 when they offered up an authorized fire by the Lord? And Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's sons, dropped dead. So this ark thing. Now, is it possible that Uzzah had proper motives, that his motives were to save the ark? But sometimes, just because your motives are right, does it also matter what you do? Not just what your motives are. You say, well, my motives are good. No, no. It matters what you do as well as your motives. It's not an either or. My motives were right, but what I did wasn't right. No, no. They both have to be right. What you do has to be right, but your motives have to be right also. So I'm saying he may have had the right motives, but what he did was he violated that which is holy, and wham, bam. So Uz is down. David freaks out. David says, well, I'm not bringing the ark up here. You know, the one guy's dead already. We're not going to do that. David's upset with that. So then David's leaves the ark there for a while. Then David realizes God's blessing the place there, and so David comes down and brings the ark up. This time, David goes down. They carry it up on the poles with the priests coming, and then seven steps, they offer up sacrifices to God, sacrifices all the way up. And then I want to read David's celebration as he brings the ark into Jerusalem. So now the ark of God is coming into Jerusalem kind of for the first time, and this is David's celebration. He's bringing the ark to the city of David. And so what happens is, it says, David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might. I was reared in a really strict Baptist church, and we didn't dance, you know. It was like illegal to dance and stuff. And you just say, yeah, it's okay, Hildebrand. White men can't dance anyways, but that's probably true, but for me anyways. But anyway, so it's really interesting here. Did David dance before the Lord? Now, question, is this guy-girl dancing kind of thing? Like, after my basketball games, my friends, there wasn't a good scene, actually. But here, David's dancing before the Lord, just in praising God, just leaping and praising God. It says, and David, wearing a linen ephod, he took off his royal robe. David takes off his royal robe. So he's down to his t-shirt and stuff, and David's out there basically getting down with the people, okay? Takes off his royal robe, and he's getting down, man. And so, before the Lord, and he's dancing with all his might while he entered, um, while while he and the entire house of Israel brought the ark of the Lord with shouts and with the sounds of trumpets. As the ark was entering into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, watched from the window. And she said, "How proud I am. Look, there is my husband bringing the ark of God into his city, Jerusalem. And my husband is leading the way as the king of Israel. Isn't this exciting?" Not. Okay, here's Michal. And when she saw, Michal saw David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. Is it possible for a wife to despise her husband? Been there sometimes. Okay, usually for good cause in my case. But she despises him. This is like the happiest day of David's life. He's dancing before the Lord, just praising God and us. He's the happiest day. He comes then home to see his wife, and he comes home to see his wife. Happiest day. He comes home to see his wife, and here's how she greets him. When David returned home, verse 20 of chapter 6, to bless, David's coming home to bless his household. Okay? As a father would bless his family and stuff. David returned home to bless his household. Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of all the slave girls." David, you really turned them on. They get down, you know, and they really like seeing the king, you know, and stuff. "And slave girls, as any vulgar fellow would." Is she being sarcastic, cynical, degrading her husband? Her husband comes home happy and excited. He goes in, he meets that. You can just see it just takes him down. Now, David, there's some things here that I don't say David's always the smartest guy in the world, okay? David does something here that I just want to tell you from my perspective is stupid, okay? And I know this to be true. My experience, I'm going to tell you it's stupid, but when you see it, you'll know it's stupid, okay? Don't do this. When you're married, don't do this. David responds, and I'm critiquing this. David said, so she says, "Oh, David, it got turned all the little slave girls on, didn't you, David?" In front of, you know, David then says to her, to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me," that's good, "it was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father." When you do the your father business, where is her father? He's dead, okay? Is that cool? "You chose me rather than your father." That rather than your father part, well, I want to tell you, when you're arguing with your spouse, you don't bring the father-in-law and you don't bring the mother-in-law into it, okay? That's just like grounds off the table. I just want to tell you, you just don't do that in a critical way. This is stupid. I can tell you from experience, it will blow up in your face. This is not good. Now, but then David says some things here that are good and stuff. "Or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's house." And then David says this, and this is beautiful. "I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this. I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." Do you see that? He says, "I'm the king. I will humiliate myself in front of them." Question, but by them will I be held in honor? A king that comes down and is like with the slave people, do the slaves then honor that? Is that a big deal? I could use that example here at Gordon College. This is the honest truth. I'm sitting up in my office, my wonderful office. Okay, some of you have been up there to see my wonderful office and stuff. I've been up there 12 years. I've never had a president of Gordon College come up, and I've never seen him on the third floor of Frost ever in 12 years. I'm here all the time. All of a sudden, I'm sitting in my office, feet kicked up, and all of a sudden, hear a knock on the door. I turn around, and come on in. Stop figuring somebody's taking a late quiz or something. Turn around. And there Honk is the president of Gordon College. I'm like, whoa. It's like totally shocked and stuff. But the guy comes up to the servant quarters and says, "Hey, what do you think about this?" And we start talking together and stuff like that. Question, that blew me away. And did I say what? Am I impressed with that? That the guy would get off, he's the president of the whole thing. He would come up and do that. Okay, that's impressive. Person of high status comes down and visits a person of low status and stuff. Now, maybe that example doesn't fit exactly, but this is David's thing. But by the way, it's really interesting here. The narrator, the next verse, the narrator puts in this. This is a sad verse. The next verse, "And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children till the day of her death." You see how the narrator says this? It kind of evens it up. She was despised David when David was praising God, and she has no children until the day of her death. And so David, all I'm trying to show here is David's passion. David is a passionate person, and he loves the Lord, and he really gets excited. He dances, the ark dancing, Michal's response, and then David saying, I will humble myself. I will humble myself, but those people that are the underlings, the lower class, will hold me in honor. So, now, this is another one of David's passion. He brings the ark to Jerusalem. But what's the problem? The ark is in a tent. Where is David living? David is living in a palace of cedar. I always wondered how that smelled. But anyways, David is living in a palace of cedar. And David says, God, in chapter 7, he says, God, you're living in a tent and I'm living in a cedar palace. I want to build a house for God. And so David says this thing, I want to build a house for God. But what happens is there's a play on words there with this term bait. Remember how he said bait lechem was house of bread? Bait means house, or bait el means house of el. David says, I want to build God a bait. I want to build God a house. I want to build God a temple. I'm going to build God a temple. And then what does God do? God comes down and says, David, you're not going to build me a temple. Because David, basically, you're a man of blood. And your son Shlomo, Solomon, who is a man of shalom, he will build the house for me. But God says, David, you want to build me a house, a temple? God says, David, I will build you a house. But when God uses the term house, there's a play on words there. He doesn't mean he will build a temple for David. When he says, I will build a house for you, David, what he's saying is, I will build you a descendants, your descendants. In other words, your descendants, your house will be your descendants. And your descendants, David, will sit on the throne of David. Your descendants will sit. I'm going to build you a descendant such that your sons will sit on the throne of David forever over Israel. Ultimately, who is going to be the son of David then? Ultimately, who is the son of David who sits on the throne? Who is that one who is to build David a house forever? It's Jesus Christ. So this is called the Davidic covenant. This is really important. Let me just back up. What covenants have we had so far? We've had the Abrahamic covenant, and God promised Abraham, what did he promise him? Land, the seed would be multiplied, and he'd be a blessing to all nations. We've had the Sinaitic covenant, where they went to Sinai, and God gave them his law of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not do murder, thou shalt not commit adultery. And he gives them his law. That was the Sinaitic covenant. So you had the Abrahamic covenant, then you had the Sinaitic covenant giving the law, and now you've got the third covenant saying, yeah, you're going to bless all nations, and how is it going to be administered? David, I'm going to make your house, your descendants, your line is going to rule over Israel forever. This is the Davidic covenant, and this points straight to Jesus, okay? This points straight to Jesus, and Jesus will be the son. By the way, Jesus will be called the what? The son of David? When Jesus goes into Jerusalem riding a donkey, what will they say to him? Hosanna, Hosanna, the son of David, okay? And they'll call Jesus, is called the son of David. Basically, he's the Messiah. That's the one they hope would rule over Israel. So anyways, this is called the Davidic covenant in this play on terms. David wants to build God a house. God says, I'll build you a house. By the way, did Nathan the prophet get it wrong here? Nathan the prophet told David, go ahead and build a temple. And then God stepped in and says, wait a minute, Nathan, you got that wrong. So God actually corrects Nathan the prophet here. But anyways, it's a beautiful passage here. This is the Davidic covenant. This is one of the three major covenants in the Old Testament. It's really something. Now, David hates evil. David's hatred of evil. And here, when the Amalekite comes and said, I slew Saul, what does David do to the Amalekite? He kills him because he touched the Lord's anointed. And David said, you don't mess with the Lord's anointed. So David has really harsh time with evil. So David has a hatred for evil, and he kills the Amalekite, and he does other things that are rather harsh that David does. David hates evil. By the way, does the Bible say cooperate with what is evil, put up with what is evil? Does the Bible say hate what is evil and love what is good? Hate what is evil, love what is good. I see a lot of the love of what is good around in this area, but question, do we hate what is evil? Or do we try to tolerate it and try to cooperate with it? We tolerate. We're going to be very tolerant people, right? So we tolerate evil. It's okay. We can handle it, evil and stuff. The Bible says, hate what is evil, love what is good. By the way, that's in the New Testament. I'm sorry for jumping ahead there. But okay, David's evil. Now we want to look at David's evil himself. And this is in chapter 11. And this is probably the most famous passage of David that everybody knows. Okay, this David's sin with Bathsheba. And let me start in chapter 11, verse 1. And it says this. In the spring, 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war. Why is that a slam on David? First of all, why do the kings go out to battle in the spring? When do the crops come up of the wheat and barley? In the spring. So if you take your troops out in the spring, can you rip off all the farmers and get food for yourself, right? Who was the genius who did war all year round? Who was one of the first people that did that? He warred all year round, and actually it wasn't him, it was his father, who actually built this fighting machine where they could have supply lines so they could go all year round rather than just in the spring. Does anybody know Alexander the Great? Okay. Alexander the Great, okay? Alexander the Great, his father, Philip Macedon, he actually built the system and stuff. Alexander did it and stuff. But normally kings went off to war in the spring because then you could just live off the crops that were coming up naturally. Is David going out to war over here in Jordan? Is it's saying in the spring when kings go off to war, is David going to go off to war with his men, or is David going to be sitting at home shacking up with this girl? Okay, so this is a slam on David right from the start here. The kings go off to war. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. Roof of the palace, high or low? Palaces are always what? High or low in the city? Palace is always high. David's king's palace is always high. David's on the roof of his house. He looks over to the other roof of his house, and there was a very beautiful woman. And David from the roof of his house, he saw a woman bathing. And I thought, oh, what do you mean? This woman's got like a bathtub up there. She's taking a bath, and David looks down, sees this woman like that. First of all, a lot of people try to accuse Bathsheba that she tries to seduce the king. Is that true? I want to say that's not true. First, let me just explain houses in Israel. The houses in Israel are shorter than from here to that pillar and over to the wall. That's the house. Question, when you're in the house, do you have privacy? There's no privacy in those homes. Do you understand? That basically things are open. When you want to get private, when you want to be by yourself, where do you go? You go up on the roof. The roof is where you have privacy. You don't have privacy down in your home. There's animals, there's people walking in and out and stuff. You got privacy, you go up on the roof. So she's one. Then question, she's bathing up there. Is this her bathing in a, you know, this big pool? First of all, would they have a bathtub? Would you waste water like that in Israel to take a bath in Israel with water? Would people waste water like that? No. She's probably taking a sponge bath, okay? That's the honest truth. Probably taking a sponge bath on her roof. David looks down and sees her, okay? This isn't, you know, her displaying herself and stuff. She's, okay. So anyways, David looks down. So be careful about, just being careful here, the process of temptation then. So David looks, he sees that she's beautiful, he sees that she's bathing, and so he sees with his eyes. So the process of temptation, the eyes. Now question, do guys have problems with their eyes? Okay, do guys have problems with their eyes? The answer is yeah. But for me, it's always the second look that kills you, because why is the second look so important? The first look is just what? You may just see something you shouldn't really be seeing and stuff like that, but when you look back the second time, is there intention there? And so what I'm saying is watch out for the second look. Classic for me was, I remodeled a house once in a place called Winona Lake, Indiana. And our house was about 6 feet, maybe 10, 12 feet from the neighbor's house on this side, 10, 12 feet from the neighbor's house on that side. I gutted the house and rewired and replumbed it and did all that junk and stuff. So we were moving down, moving into the house. So I'm on my way up to school. I walk to school, and I'm a morning person, a serious morning person. I usually get up, I think this morning I was awake at about 10 to 5, and I usually get out. I just want to tell you, because my wife gets up a lot later and stuff, when you get up at, you know, 5, 5:30 and stuff, it's dark out then. And so I go out the door of my house, and it was early, I don't know, 6, 6:30 or something like that. And I walk out the door of my house, and I'm going to walk up to school. It's about 2 blocks up to the school. And as I walk out the door of my house, there is Kim, our neighbor, about a 25-year-old woman who's married to her husband, Rich, and stuff. And there's a window there, and it had frosting on it. You know what I'm saying? Frosted windows that you can't see through? But what's the problem when you put a light behind the frosted window? all of a sudden, they know frosting there, if you know what I mean. So I'm standing there, and here's this woman standing there, bliko busha, as the Hebrews say, stark anyways, and she's taking a shower right there, and I'm saying, holy cow, you know? And I'm thinking, wow, man, 6 o'clock every morning, we get free shows. No, that was a joke. Okay, now. So, sorry. So I go by, I go up to school. Now question, do I have a problem? And you say, what do I do tomorrow? And you say, question, I got a wife. Do I tell my wife? You say, what are you, out of your mind? You don't tell your wife that kind of stuff. Question, I got a wife. Question, does my wife know basically every thought that goes through my head? Do I tell my wife stuff like that? And you say, you don't do that. And the answer is yes. We have a totally open, honest relationship. And I went home that day. I knew I had to tell her. I said, Annette, I said, you got to do something. Go over and talk to Kim. Just tell him to put up a curtain there and we're cool and stuff like that. But I said, you got to go over and talk to her and tell her to cover that window. What did my wife say to me? She says, how can I go over there and tell him, hey, please put a curtain up there. My husband has a problem. She says, how am I going to tell her to put a curtain up there that it's a problem? She says, I can't do that. And so she didn't do it. Now do I got a bigger problem? So question, the honest truth is, did I have to purposely, intentionally walk out the opposite door of my house on the opposite side and go up to school from that side every day for about a year and a half? And then when Joe and his wife moved in, the next couple moved in, what was the first thing was over there? And I do it myself. You got to get a curtain up in this window as soon as Joe moved in. And he knew right away, and so it was no problem after that. What I'm saying is, you get in some situations, you have to be careful about your eyes. Question, we live in an internet age. Do you have to be careful about your eyes? As I look over in the seat over there, I see a student at Gordon College looking at pornography at Gordon College. You say, how did you get past that? Anyways, and sitting in a seat right over there. And what I'm saying is this a big problem in our culture? Big problem. So I'm saying guard your eyes, guys, especially. Guard your eyes, guard your heart and stuff. Second looks. Now, what happens? David sees her, but if he doesn't act, but does David take action now? He invites her up. Now, question, is this Bathsheba's problem? She invites him up. Some people say, oh, she's going up to seduce the king. Question, when he invites her up, where is her husband, by the way? Her husband, Uriah the Hittite, this guy isn't even Jewish, is out fighting David's war over in this area in Jordan. And David invites her up. When he invites her up, is she thinking she's going to get seduced, or is she probably thinking, what's David going to tell her? Her husband's out in battle, that David's going to tell her that her husband's been killed or hurt or something like that. So she goes up to see the king. The king seduces her. Now, by the way, is she partially culpable? I mean, it's mutual consent kind of thing at that point. But then what's the problem? And the problem is, I want to say back off this blaming of Bathsheba. It's always the woman's fault. I don't think so. I think she consented to it eventually and stuff, but I think her coming up to David, she was probably thinking that he was going to tell her that her husband was dead, okay, and report that. Now, David and Bathsheba have relations. She finds out she's pregnant. Has her husband been out on the field for quite a while? She finds out she's pregnant. Does that take time? Okay, her husband's been on the field. So now David does what? He's got to cover his sin. So what does he do? He invites Uriah the Hittite back, and he says, send Uriah back here. So Uriah comes back, David comes in and says, hey, how's the war going? What's going on out there? You know, how's the war going? Stuff like that. What does David figure? The guy's been out on the field for at least a couple, 3-4 months. When he gets back home, what's the first person he's going to want to see? Is he going to want to see the king? Forget the king, man. He's going to want to see his wife, okay? Now what happens? Does he go down and see his wife? No. And I've heard some people say, well, that shows you that Uriah had a bad relationship with Bathsheba, and that's why Bathsheba cheated on him, because he had a bad relation. No. Does Uriah tell us exactly why he doesn't go down to his wife? Uriah explains to David why he didn't. He says, David, the Ark of God and Joab and all my buddies are out fighting a war. How can I go sleep with my wife when the Ark is out there? Do you hear the irony there? Do you hear the irony there? The Ark of God, David. He's a Jebusite. He's not even a Jew. And he's got more respect for the Ark of God and stuff. So then basically what happens is David says, okay, the guy won't go sleep with his wife. So, hey, when you want to get somebody to do something that they wouldn't do when they're thinking about it, what do you get to do? You get them drunk. So David says, let's get Uriah drunk. When he gets drunk, is he going to go home? When he gets drunk, he's going to go home. Even drunk, he won't go home. Has this guy got moral core principles, okay? So now what happens? David sends Uriah back out to the front lines, back over to Joab, and he tells Joab, put him on the front line, and then pull your troops back so Uriah will be killed. Now, by the way, is Joab worried about killing people? This is Joab. Okay, so Joab puts him out there, pulls the troops back, sends the message back to David. Uriah's dead. Everything's taken care of, David. David gets away with it. Now, this is David's sin, not only the immorality with Bathsheba, but now the murder of Uriah the Hittite and stuff, who showed great uprightness. Uriah was a good person. He worked with the Jews. He was Uriah the Hittite. And, very interesting. Very interesting. In the genealogy of Jesus Christ, whose name gets on there? She who was Uriah's wife. In the genealogy of David, it doesn't even mention Bathsheba's name. It mentions Uriah's name in the genealogy of Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 1. So I want to say Uriah is a good man. He was a good man. He was off at war. And by the way, when guys are off at war, do their wives cheat on them? Guys are off to war, do their wives cheat on them? My son was in Iraq. He said every one of the guys he was with that was married, every last one of them except one, their wives cheated on them when they were... Now, Talinda goes into battle. He goes into battle fighting for his life. He knows that his wife's at home cheating on him, sleeping with somebody else. Question, how do you fight a war when you know that kind of stuff's going on, you know? And the only one that was faithful in Afghanistan or in Iraq, when he went to Afghanistan, he came back, the only one that was left. Guess what? When he got back from Afghanistan, he got shot through the neck. And it missed by less than a millimeter as the aorta coming down. He goes to his wife and he says to his wife, basically, honey, you know, I love you. She gets him back and she's like all over him, okay? He says, I got to have space. I'm not the same person. He's seen all sorts of stuff. There's a lot of stuff that happens in war. He says, I just need some space. I can't just be like I was. I've changed now. And I just need some space. I just need some space. And he kept saying it. She couldn't give him space. And the next thing she did, ran up the credit card to $10,000. See you later, Charlie, and divorced him. Okay? That's really sad. And that was the only one left. Now, question, did my son have a good view of these things? No. It's all messed up. But anyway, it's just what I'm saying is, in war, did these kind of things happen in the background? The answer is yes. Now, what happens? Nathan shows up. Nathan is the prophet. And Nathan is going to go to David. And Nathan is going to tell David a story about a guy with little lambs. Does David know about sheep and getting attached to little lambs? David knows all about that. And Nathan is going to say, there was a really wealthy guy. He had all these sheep, no problem. And this one guy had this one little lamb that used to rest in his arms and stuff. And when the rich man, somebody came to his house, the rich man said, oh, we need to have a little bit of lamb food here. So he went and took the lamb from the poor man and ripped it off and butchered it. And David was furious. That guy deserves to die. And Nathan looks at him and does what the prophets do the best. He says, David, you're the man. You're the man, David. You're the one. You had all these wives. You had all this stuff. But you took, this guy had his one wife. You took her and then you killed him. And so Nathan basically is a prophet. What is the role of the prophet? Does the role of the prophet to rebuke the king? The prophet rebukes the king. Then what's the king do usually? Kills the prophet. Okay, the prophets usually lose. John the Baptist, you get your head cut off. Jeremiah, you get put in a septic tank for 3 days. Okay, so anyways. But what with David? Does David kill Nathan? No, David repents. And I want to look at David's repentance next time. We'll actually go through the process of repentance and stuff. So, okay, see you on Tuesday.
This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his Old Testament History, Literature, and Theology course, lecture number 24, on David, his compassion, his passion, and his hatred of evil.